This podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional help. If you or someone you know is facing difficulties, I advise you consult a psychologist. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Psych for Life with Dr. Amanda Ferguson. I'm your host, Dr. Amanda Ferguson. Today's episode is about how our digital habits are impacting our stress and relationships and what we can do to tame them with Dr. Christy Goodwin. Dr. Christy Goodwin studies what it takes to thrive in the digital world. Dr. Christy is the author of Dear Digital, We Need to Talk, where she decodes the neurobiology of peak performance in a digital age. Described by her clients as a pracademic, Christy translates cutting-edge research and science into realistic strategies to bolster productivity and enhance well-being in the always-on digital world. Christy has worked with large and small organizations to help employees, leaders, and teams ignite peak performance in their professional and personal lives. And Dr. Christy is a researcher and is frequently called on by the media for her expert opinion on how technology is shaping our focus, our physical health, and our mental well-being. Having presented to global audiences, Christy wants to help you tame your digital behaviors so you can flourish online and offline. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you, Amanda. It's great to be here with you.
Lovely to chat. You have so much experience working in this area, clearly such a passion for this work. What led you to this mission, as you say, that you're on?
It is a real mission, and I'll be completely honest, I wish I had a very fancy career trajectory mapped out and I simply adhered to that. But if truth be told, I fell into this work through a series of serendipitous events. I had started my career as an educator. I then went into academic life and completed a PhD where I examined the impact that technology was having on what I call screenagers, kids and teens. How were their brains and bodies being shaped by their digital immersion? But I became somewhat of a frustrated academic. I could see all of this great research being done, but I knew as a parent that it often wasn't disseminated to parents. Academics weren't sharing this research to people on the ground. You know, time-poor parents, teachers, and health professionals didn't have the time to read peer-reviewed academic journals or to attend the conferences where this cutting-edge research was shared. Yeah. So I became a conduit for the research and taking it and translating it into practical information. And the catalyzing event for me to start to focus on adults' use of technology, because before we recorded, we were just saying no human is immune to the digital pool. We all get sucked into the digital vortex, you know, scrolling social media, binge watching Netflix, triaging our inboxes. And so it was an event that happened with my son. I have three boys, and my middle son, Billy, decided one day he was not going to have a nap. He was about 15 months at the time. Now, I had ambitiously scheduled a work call during his anticipated nap time. And when I saw that he was not having a nap, he'd cancelled that. I opened the lid on my laptop just to send one email to cancel, and it was back in the day of Skype, when Skype was your video call. So I opened the lid on my laptop just to send that one email, and I saw that awful red icon telling me that I had 144 unread emails. I started to triage the avalanche of emails in my inbox, and I wasn't watching Billy, who was climbing on the lounge. Remember, he's about 15 months. Mm-hmm. Billy fell face first off the lounge, smashed his face, and required urgent hospitalization.
Oh, dear.
And it was at that point in time where I had to examine my digital habits and behaviors. You know, for many years as adults, we've wagged the finger at young people and said they're addicted, they can't put it down, you know, they're obsessed, they've got a digital appendage. But I don't think we've examined our digital habits as adults. And, you know, tech has got its tentacles into every part of our lives, professionally and personally. Mm. And so that awful moment really was the catalyst for me to say, what is it about the online world that draws us in? How can we not be a slave to the screen? How can we use technology? Because it's not a, you know, do a digital detox, give up social media message. That's antiquated and outdated. It's all about how can we use technology, but to do so in a way that is congruent rather than in conflict with how we're designed as humans. So that's accident really was what propelled me to look at this. No. Just to alleviate my mother's guilt, because I could see your reaction sharing that story. I will declare that he'd done, Billy had had a very similar accident 2 weeks prior when my husband was dutifully supervising him. So I'm suggesting that the severity of the lip split was just a reopening of an existing wound.
How is Billy now?
He's fine, but do you know what? Still to this day, so that accident was nearly 8.5 years ago, and still to this day, he has a very tangible scar on his lip that is a concrete reminder to me about, you know, how my tech habits, even though this was what I researched and spoke about, I wasn't immune to the digital pull. So it is, I guess, a concrete reminder to not so subtly, remind me of what this mission is. This is about sharing the research and science, because I think most of us intuitively know that our digital habits and behaviors don't always serve us. Mm. They often enslave us. Yes. So his scar is sort of that concrete reminder that this mission and this work is really important, because people want pragmatic solutions. They want to learn how they can form a healthy relationship with technology and not be that slave to the screen that I mentioned earlier.
Absolutely. And a slave to the stress that caused you.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And the accident that happened after the stress, because that stress is the build-up to something that may be worse.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And you also mentioned that this digital behaviors impacting our interpersonal and other relationships, that we're rarely idle with our thoughts, and we often feel every bit of the white space with screens and that absence of mind wandering that we used to have where we'd daydream. And that's so important for our epiphanies. We know that epiphanies or realizations come from that daydream time where we have these major life understandings and realizations, and we're losing all of that. How does that impact us?
Huge impact. We are spending an inordinate amount of time on our screens. Research tells us, or it estimates, that the average Australian adult at the moment, now this is before AI, before the metaverse really sort of permeates our lives, but at the moment, Australian research estimates the average adult will spend a whopping 17 years of their life on their phones. That's just our phones. 17 years of our life, 33% of our waking hours, we are on our phones.
Oh my goodness.
This displacement effect, there is an opportunity cost. You know, as humans, we have to deal or reconcile with the fact that we are living in a world of finitude. We have a finite lifespan. We've got finite number of hours in the day. If we are dedicating that much time to our phones alone, what's being displaced?
Yeah.
And we know, as you said, one of the critical things for our relationship with ourselves, our relationship being present and connected so we can connect with others. Research is telling us that we are more connected digitally, but disconnected as humans. Mm. You know, and a digital communication, whilst it can be a good complementary tool, it does not ever supplement face-to-face connection. Mm. A study was done and they compared what happened when somebody had a text-based dialogue with somebody. So they sent a WhatsApp message or an SMS. What happened was that the brain started to release cortisol, the stress hormone, just by the sheer fact. Now, that's for a whole host of reasons. One, it could be the content of what you were typing. Yeah. Two, we know from a biological perspective is that when our eyes converge on a small surface area, like they do our phone, our laptop, our tablet, it triggers the stress response.
Wow.
Because as humans, we are biologically designed to dilate our gaze. We're designed to look at things in the distance. We're not designed to spend hour upon hour with this really small surface area. So that study showed we made the cortisol. In comparison, when we had a similar conversation but face-to-face with somebody, our brain produced oxytocin, mm-hmm. the social bonding hormone.
Yep.
We cannot yet, and I'm not sure whether we'll ever get to the point where the technology is so advanced and sophisticated, where we can have that oxytocin produced through digital communications.
Yep.
So it's having a profound impact. Now, you talked about that being idle and being bored. I like to call it letting our mind meander.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember, Amanda, when you used to get on the bus and just stare out the window.
Yeah.
You'd order your coffee and you'd stand there and be idle with your thoughts.
Yeah.
You'd pull up at a red traffic light and your mind would meander.
Yes.
Today, because technology has become frictionless, it's literally in our pockets, it's soon going to be on our faces constantly, we often fill that white space with scrolling. And we know, I don't know, I often ask audiences when I'm speaking, I say, think of your last great idea, a complex problem that you spent months agonizing over, where did that idea germinate? And I ask people, I say, tell me, where did it germinate? 90% of people usually say in the shower, when I was going for a walk or a swim, when I was on a plane with no Wi-Fi back in the good old-fashioned days, when I was bored.
Yes.
It's that unplugged time. I've never ever, in the thousands of people I've asked that question to, never ever had one person say in my inbox or in an Excel spreadsheet.
Absolutely.
And so that germination of ideas, creativity, but also intimately knowing what excites us, what terrifies us, what intrigues us, only comes about when we have those moments of introspection. And I think we are just filling every bit of white space with our screens. So it's impacting not only the connection we have with others, but also the connection we have with ourselves.
Oh, so true. And people seem to be so excited about what the digital can provide us and the stimulation. And yet, as you said, the deficits, what it's depriving us from, taking us away from, we need to really lean into that and remember that things come at a price.
Yeah, there's an opportunity cost. And we are seeing this firsthand at the moment. We have numerous studies telling us that rates, global rates, and also here in Australia, rates of stress and burnout are increasing at a really staggering rate. And I believe one, not the only, but one of the chief contributing factors are our digital habits.
Yes.
The pervasive, subtle, but very powerful way our tech habits have crept into every crevice of our lives, but are making us feel stressed. You know, I mentioned before the narrow gaze, you know, that biological triggers stress. I think two things have happened. The first thing is that our tech habits have added a huge amount of tiny little micro stresses.
Yes.
Now, on their own, these micro stresses would be benign. They would be harmless. You know, they wouldn't even register.
Yeah.
Something as simple as a notification. I often say, we have ancient Paleolithic brains. We have brains that are biologically designed to go and forage, hunt, and get information.
Yep.
We do not have brains that have evolved to have information and huge amounts.
Mm.
It's estimated the average adult is processing a whopping 74 gigabytes worth of information professionally and personally every day.
Wow.
Our brain has not evolved. You know, the hippocampus, which is our memory center, has not got any larger to accommodate this extra information.
Yeah.
So we're being peppered with these micro stresses, video meetings. We've got numerous brain scans telling us that the brain finds virtual meetings stressful.
Mm.
Multitasking. Many of us are guilty now. Microsoft data suggests that about 78% of people in Teams meetings are now triaging their emails or their Teams chats. So we're spending our days, you know, with these tiny little micro stresses that accumulate.
Yeah.
The second thing that I think is happening at the same time is that our digital habits have eroded, I might even say annihilated, the biological buffers that were once naturally baked into our days that used to bring us back to a stress baseline.
Yes.
Connection, sleep, physical movement,
yep.
dealing with stress. You know, technology has made us very comfortable with being comfortable. I'm hungry, I order Uber Eats. I'm hot, I flick on the air conditioner. I'm cold, I turn on the heater. When we are ill-equipped to deal with physical stress, then we're often ill-equipped to deal with psychological stress. So I think it's the collision of those two factors. We've added little micro stresses and we've nullified some of the buffers that used to bring us back to the stress baseline. And that's why I think we're seeing these really dire statistics when it comes to stress and burnout.
Absolutely. And we know burnout actually can lead ultimately to suicide. And I think what you're touching on too reminds me that people think that this is an easier, quicker, less stressful way of living, and that socializing is too stressful and takes too much effort. But they're deluding themselves or being deluded by the big tech companies that this is instant gratification and less stressful, when in fact the so-called stress of socializing brings, as you said, the oxytocin, the dopamine, all the other wonderful hormones. And most of our brains, I believe, are built for physical socializing, not for this tech socializing and interaction. as you
Yeah,
say.
and then we look about sometimes the responsibility, and this is a very big conversation, but the ethical responsibility, particularly of social media platforms. We know as humans, we have something built into our biology called the negativity bias.
Yes.
So we tend to click on the news headlines, or we open or expand the Instagram post or watch the TikTok video of something that's more negatively geared. What we inadvertently do is that we fuel the algorithm to serve us up more of that content.
Yes.
And so we are in many ways fueling this. And so we have to, I think, look at our digital habits. It's not about, as I said, I call it digital amputation. Cutting it off completely isn't a plausible strategy in 2024. It's all about instead, how do we find ways of using technology that are congruent, are aligned with how we are designed as humans. And I call that our human operating system, our HOS,
yes.
And that is our brain and body. We have some, I think, fortunate, other people might say unfortunate, biological constraints. We cannot outperform our biology. We have a blueprint and we have to adhere to it. And what I think's happened in the last several years is that our tech habits are completely misaligned with how we are designed to operate and function as human beings.
I love that spin on it, that this is a positive thing, that we are limited with our biology, and really owning that limitation and honouring and respecting ourselves as a biological human being first and foremost, being in charge of tech, not tech being in charge of us.
Yes, technology makes a great servant. It should not be your master.
Absolutely.
And I think if many adults took a harsh look in the mirror and reflected on their digital habits, they would perhaps question whether they are the servant or the master. And again, through no fault of our own, there's often a whole lot of persuasive design techniques that tech companies deploy that get us hooked on their platforms. And there's often a misnomer that it's just social media platforms or gaming platforms that use some of these techniques. Many of our workplace technologies use these techniques to get us to check the message, you know, respond to the Teams chat. You know, something as simple as your notification bubble by default is usually red.
Yes.
It is associated with danger, urgency, importance. The fact that it comes to you, it's a push notification, tricks your brain into thinking it is urgent and important. The fact that there's often a metric telling you how many unread emails or Teams messages or DMs you've got often drives your behavior. So there's a whole lot of things that have been put in place. But again, there are things we can do within our locus of control that help us certainly use. This is not an anti-tech conversation that, you know, we have to use technology, but how can we embed our digital habits into our lives in ways that empowers us and powers us up? I think for many people at the moment, we are being powered down by the very technologies that were meant to make us more efficient and productive.
Yes, and in contrast to that, organizational psychology knows that soft skills are going to make the leaders of the future.
Absolutely.
Yes, so those that are in charge of themselves over tech are the ones that are going to be most successful in the future.
Yeah, and can I share something here? This is a Christism, I might say. So for many years, we talked about IQ being a good predictor of a person's lifelong outcomes. And then in more recent years, we said, no, a better predictor is a person's EQ, their emotional intelligence. I believe there is a new super skill of the 21st century that trumps a person's IQ and their EQ. The super skill, the determining factor of your success, whether you are a student, whether you are a professional or a leader in a workplace, the skill of the 21st century is our FQ. I have to be very careful how I say that one. Your focus quotient, your capacity to orient, control, and direct your focus and attention will be a determining factor in a world that has been engineered to be distracting and to divert your attention. So, yes, I agree. Soft skills, that skill of focus, in my opinion, and what I believe the research is pointing to, will be a determining factor in your success.
I love that. And so let's look at solutions. So how can we tame our tech habits, Christy?
Yes. So I believe we have to build a fortress around our focus. So when we want to be present with our partner, when we want to be present with our mum, when we want to be present with a colleague during an important call, put your phone somewhere where you cannot see it. Research from the University of Austin, Texas, told us that even if our phone was on silent and face down, If it was still in our line of sight while we were trying to get work done, it dropped our cognitive performance roughly by around 10%.
Wow.
Put bluntly, seeing your phone makes you about 10% dumber.
Yes.
Another study had restaurant goers. They split the group into two. Half the group took their phone in as they normally would, whether they put that on the table, left it in their pocket or their handbag. And the control group, they had them leave their phone in a box outside of the restaurant. At the end of the meal, they asked the participants to judge two things. One, the flavor and the taste of the food, and two, the quality of the conversation they had with their dinner guests at the restaurant. Which group do you think enjoyed the meal more and had richer, deeper conversation?
The control group.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And so something as simple as putting our phone somewhere where we don't see it when we want to be present, when we want to get that deep, focused work done. Another really simple, I call them micro habits, is to control your notifications. Remember, unsolicited notifications come to you and trick your brain into thinking this is urgent and important. It flashed, it's in a red bubble, my screen keeps illuminating. This must require my urgent attention. So my three golden rules with notifications is one, disable all non-essential notifications. Unless you are in sales or customer service, I don't believe anyone else really needs email notifications pinging on their phone throughout the day. Two, bundle or batch your notifications. So you can now nominate on most apps and digital platforms what time or times of the day you want your notifications coming to you rather than them dribbling in and distracting you throughout the day. And third, can you create VIP lists so that when you activate focus mode or do not disturb mode, everybody gets blocked apart from those people on that list? Maybe that's your aging parents. Maybe it's, your child care center or your children's school. Maybe it's your partner. Maybe it's your mother-in-law. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a colleague and you're working on a time-sensitive project. You get to nominate who comes through. So I think managing those notifications. And my third one is around having a digital curfew. We know that screen use in the 60 minutes before we go to sleep will not only delay the onset of sleep,
Yep.
but it also shrinks the duration of our deep and REM sleep. That is when memory consolidation occurs. So the problem today is that many people are not only not getting enough sleep, often because of their binge watching Netflix or revenge bedtime procrastination at night associated with their screen use, the hyper-aroused state of their brain if they are still processing, tapping, swiping, responding at night, but also they're not getting good quality of sleep because when you are on a blue light device before you go to sleep, you don't make as much melatonin, and impaired melatonin production will shrink those restorative parts of your sleep. So trying to come up with some good digital hygiene, especially before when we go to sleep, can have a huge impact on our well-being and productivity.
And there's some research about being on screen as soon as you wake up causing a negative effect as well.
Absolutely. So I say to people, the research says 8 to 15 minutes. I just tell people 15. I forget about the 8 minutes. I say if you can keep the first 15 minutes screen free, because your brain transitions out of a beautiful theta state. And that's often when ideas germinate or we solve the complex problem we've spent months agonizing over. But if we pick up our phone, as most people do, first thing in the morning, we agitate our limbic brain and we only need to see one upsetting email, one disappointing sports, score, the weather looks detrimental, a nasty post on social media, and we agitate that part of the brain. We also, if we wake up and pick up our phone straight away, activate the beta, which is the busy brain state. This is not how we're designed to start. Another really common thing about our tech habits in the morning, and so many of us do this, we know, in fact, research estimates 90% of adults reach for their phone before their partner first thing in the morning. A consequence of that is that if we're on our phones first thing in the morning and we're getting that, the blue light, what we're not often getting, and this is also impacting our children and teens, the research is corroborating this, is we're often not getting natural sunlight. Sunlight in the first hour of waking up, and you only require 10 minutes on a sunny day, 20 on an overcast day. But sunlight within the first hour of waking up does two things for your brain. First thing it does is it activates your hypothalamus, so it puts you in an alert focus state. Many people are struggling with their focus and attention because they wake up, activate that beta busy brain state. They're not getting that sunlight, so they're not in an alert focus state. But the other thing that happens magically from getting exposure to sunlight within that first hour is that 16 hours later, your body will naturally start to produce the sleep hormone melatonin.
Yeah.
But many people are not getting that these days. You know, we get up, we get on our devices, we get on public transport or in our cars, and off we are to work and into the office. So those simple mechanics and mechanisms that we need as humans are really important that we prioritize.
Yeah, and coming back to ourselves as humans, as biological humans, neurological humans, who still have all these basic needs, and it's going to be to our detriment if we're not meeting those needs.
Yes. And I have a lot of people push back on this, say to me, but Christy, don't we evolve? Won't our brains change? Yes, our brains will change, but it will take thousands of years for that evolutionary process to take place. And at the same time, the technology is going to keep evolving and changing too. So I think that my perspective, and I'm sure you would agree, Amanda, is that we have to acknowledge that we are human beings and that there are some harsh, I think great, biological constraints. How can we integrate? How can we exploit the benefits that technology offers us, but in a way that works for our human operating system rather than against us. And I think that's why we're not doing that at the moment particularly well. This is why we've got increased mental health issues, why we've got an epidemic of loneliness, why we've got increasing rates of stress and burnout. Our tech habits have, pushed us away from how we are designed as humans. And that is something I think we urgently need to address.
Yes, and psychologists too often hear the problem of device addiction interrupting relationships and even threatening to destroy relationships and families. And, you know, the curfew, as you mentioned, is so important when it comes to families and relationships, that they switch their phones off, put them away, have a docking system where all family phones go into a corner once you enter the house, and there's a real guided boundary system of how you manage those devices.
Absolutely. I call that creating your digital guardrails. So I do work with corporations, and at an organizational level, we articulate what are the digital norms, practices, and principles that underpin how we're going to use technology. But equally, I think individuals, families, people need their own digital guardrails. We don't have to be always responsive. You know, we have created something in the online world called the urgency fallacy. Everything feels urgent and important, and in most instances, it's not. So we have to put up those parameters and put up those, you know, where are the places and spaces where you're not going to use screens? How will you deal with after-hours communications? In Australia, we've seen recent legislation in this regard around the right to disconnect.
Yes.
Already in the UK, there is research looking at this being rolled out there as well. So, yeah, those guardrails are certainly important at an organisational level, but I think at an individual level, we can come up with some of those parameters and practices that will support us.
Absolutely, because the right to disconnect is a workplace initiative, but relationships and families back in the home, that's where there's got to be a right to disconnect and a need, and the incentive is to keep the family healthy and the relationship intact.
Absolutely, really critical.
So Dr. Christie, I always ask my guests, what makes you psyched for life?
I am someone who in recent years has really struggled to switch off. As somebody who is a high performer, I had the outdated, non-scientifically validated view that I needed to keep going. I needed to keep pushing and keep, turning over work at a rapid rate, until I started to read some of the neuroscience behind how long we can actually focus on tasks, how much deep work we can basically get done a day, and why resting is a responsibility and not a reward. And so I am proud to say that I have felt more psyched for life when I have honored the way my brain is designed. The harsh reality is we only have about 4 to 6 hours per day of deep work. That is the work that we would undertake that activates our prefrontal cortex, that heavy lifting kind of work. We're not designed to consistently pump out 12, 14 hour days. So honoring that, trying to structure my day so that I can get that deep focused work done free from distractions, but also honoring I need to rest. I need to recover. It's not an optional extra. As someone who has learned this the hard way through experiencing burnout, I have learned I'm far more psyched for life when I honour that sort of operational cadence of having concentrated chunks of work time, but also ensuring that I rest and recover. It has been instrumental in my life.
And whether that means gardening, going for a walk, reading a non-work-based book, catching up with friends, going out with your partner.
Yep. All those basic things that we enjoy and our brains need. Something even as simple as closing your eyes for 30 seconds. 30 seconds of closing your eyes gives your occipital lobe a break. And so many of us today are on some sort of screen or device constantly. You know, there are really simple things that we can do, and it's not onerous. The research consistently tells us that piccolo breaks, so really short breaks, 2 to 10 minutes in duration, but interspersed throughout our days, are the most effective way to beat burnout. It's not complicated. You don't need months and months of annual leave, although you might like that. The best way to beat burnout are just those small incremental breaks interspersed throughout the day.
So invaluable. Thank you so much, Dr. Christie. Now, people can find you on your website, which is www.drchristiegoodwin.com, for all your resources, your wonderful resources, which include your new book, Dear Digital, We Need to Talk, and people can find a digital copy of your book, Productivity Hacks, Wellbeing Box Cards, and so much more, and to also find you to ask you to present to their workplace or other organisations, and so many more products that are there and resources on your website.
Lovely. Thank you for sharing, Amanda. I appreciate your time and your audience's focus on confronting this tricky topic that many of us are wrestling with.
Thank you so much, Dr. Christie.
Pleasure. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Plus, don't forget you can access all of the resources mentioned in today's podcast via the show notes. Is there a pressing issue or topic you'd like me to discuss? Head to my Instagram at @dramandaferguson and send me a DM. I love hearing from my listeners. If anything discussed in this podcast has caused you concern or distress, contact your general practitioner or health provider. To locate a psychologist in your area, call the Australian Psychological Society and locate Find a Psychologist service on 1800 333 497, or visit www.findapsychologist.org.au. If you or someone you know is in crisis, Lifeline is available 24/7 on 13 11 14 and Kids Helpline, again 24/7 on 1800 55 1800, and both are free of charge. To find out more about me, please visit my website, dramandaferguson.com.au. You can find the link in my show notes. The opinions expressed by guests in these podcasts aren't necessarily shared by me.